She cries harder. She wasn't in his heart, not the way she wanted to be. His heart that isn't beating anymore. "Honey," I say, "you've been wonderful, and we can get you home now."
"Wait," she says. "The hipster guy, is it possible he, like, stabbed Krish or poisoned him? Like some James Bond thing, some pen weapon?"
I pat her on the back. This is also par for the course. Everyone wants to play, let's pretend someone is to blame, someone besides God or Mother Nature. "No," I say. "Romy, the EMTs are certain that this was heart failure." I say the words I've had so much trouble believing myself.
"But it was so sudden."
"As it is sometimes." A clang over by the coroner.
"Jesus,"
Romy says. She's never seen any of this, never seen a person become a body. I promise her this is normal. The waves, the tears. You don't accept a death all at once.
"It's an awful thing, hon."
"You take it as it comes." She thanks me, and I'm helping her. Sometimes I think I would have been a good father. I offer her a lozenge.
"Thank you,"
she says. She pops it in her mouth.
"Oh,"
she wrestles the lozenge with her tongue.
"One more thing about the guy."
She holds up a finger.
"I am Providence."
"Who is Providence?"
"That's what it said on his hat,"
she says.
"I am Providence. Can you think of anything more narcissistic to put on a hat? I mean, screw you, guy, you're not Providence. You're walking around in a haze with your head and your phone. Krish, he was Providence."
Her voice trails off, and then more tears. I scribble the words in my notepad. I am Providence. Where did this guy go? Did they get him in a bus to a hospital? She shakes her head.
"I have no idea. He just disappeared."
There is no case. This was a heart attack. We get the security footage, and Romy described it to a T. The beard is lost in his phone, oblivious. He bumps into Krish. Krish goes berserk. He pounds on the beard until Krish clearly goes into arrest. People swarm, and the beard slinks away. For the most part, his hat blocks his face. But who wouldn't get out of there? All that madras, all that noise. The beard probably figured he caught a break, slinked off to one of the local hospitals to get his wounds licked. But then I call the local hospitals. I call all of them. The campus infirmaries. I call every CVS, every pharmacy. Nothing. No beard. I watch the video again. But there is nothing there either. No clue about the beard. I go to Stacy, who's 7 months pregnant, tearing the lid off a yogurt. I tell her about the video, the kid Krish beat up, how he's nowhere to be found. She eats her yogurt with that stupid plastic spoon they stick at the top. She has a metal spoon right there on her desk.
"Krish had a heart attack," she says.
Declares. That's the word. While beating the hell out of this kid, gave the kid a cracked rib at the very least, a broken nose. She licks the lid of her yogurt as if it's so delectable, as if it isn't just yogurt.
"Eggy," she says, "Krish was an Ivy League Olympic contender, a good kid. This kid you can't find hanging around Thayer Street, he's probably a dealer, a bad kid."
I make a mental note. A dealer. She glares at me.
"But he's not our problem, and he didn't throw a punch." She glares harder. A mother. A mom. Krish is a good kid, Eggie. We're not going to go making him bad, trying to look for a connection that isn't there.
An hour later, I still want to know what happened. I get like this. It's the cop in me, the true detective. Stacy is in this to protect and serve. But I am a bloodhound. Like Lo tearing through one of her books, wanting to get to the end. I am the same way. I have to know what happened. I am Providence. It sounds like the kind of thing some shit for brains politician would say if he was trying to get elected. I write down all my young kids, the ones whose hearts gave out on them. I wonder, did they know the beard? And that's when it's time to go home, when I need to go upstairs to my office, when I start to wonder.
John, I didn't have a nightmare last night. I don't even remember dreaming. Not having the nightmare is worse than all the nightmares combined. It means I'm getting used to this. I tear the sheets off the bed and shove them in the washing machine. Then I go online to punish myself with all the stories about Krishna. It's a relief that it hurts my soul, that I'm crying, that the pain is a dagger, the guilt. He was a good fucking guy. He was the oldest of three kids, seat four on the Brown University crew team. He loved Harry Potter. His friends called him Krish Potter, Krish P. He was Harry Potter every Halloween. This giant guy in these little glasses and this cape that's not big enough. The New York Times talks about him being a minority on the water, and the Projo praises him. He was good for our city. His parents are said to be broken, and he's never alone in any of the pictures unless it's part of a joke, like he's standing by a statue of a bear, posing. He was gonna win us some Olympic medals. In this fucked up way that I can't even wrap my head around, I didn't just kill a person. I killed America. I check my Peter Fader mail, and there's a form letter response from Lin Wu, a Lovecraft expert I found online. Hi, Peter. I wish I could respond to all inquiries personally, but I'm on the road right now. As you might suspect, I'm sharpening my talons for Necronomicon in Providence, where I'd be happy to answer your questions. Tickets are on sale now. Cthulhu, you there? Lin. I throw my sheets in the dryer. How can I go to the convention? There are so many people. I can't control my powers. And unlike Wilbur, I blend in. Lovecraft went on and on about how weird Wilbur was, chinless and pale, growing too fast. And that's fair. The townspeople were right to be suspicious. Wary. The playing field is leveled when you can identify your enemy, when you can protect yourself. Everyone could look at Wilbur and sense that something was dangerous about him. Off. But I look like a hipster who eats bacon and has a girlfriend and a bunch of plaid shirts and plans on Friday night. I could have a Twitter profile with retweets, a hangover from cheap beer and tickets to a sweaty concert where I'd bounce so close with all the other sweaty people. You look at me, you assume I have ex-girlfriends and pictures of me doing stuff with these girls, picking apples out near Johnston, going to the old movie theater on Thayer Street, pushing our way through all the people to the bar at Paragon, to get drinks and talk about the movie and laugh and then go for falafel because we're drunk and we need to eat before we have sex. Sex. My dryer buzzes. I take my hot sheets and wrap them all around me. I think this is how sex would feel. The other body would be hot, and it would be like a blanket touching you in all different places. The warmth of another thing. I call Chloe, and I get her voicemail. It's just as well. I don't deserve the sound of her voice. Not today. Sometimes you can't win. But the second I get better, I'll tell her everything. I'll apologize for being such a douchebag, my mixed messages, for disappearing. I'll be the person I am, the person I was before he took me. A good person. And I'll never be that person if I don't do everything I can to try to find a cure. It's the sick truth of what Magnus said. We did good work down here, John. I may not like the work, what he did, but he worked hard. He did it. He made me this way. And now it's my turn. You gotta try. It isn't safe to go to Lovecraft, but it wasn't safe to cut through the woods all those years ago. You don't win without risk.
Chloe. There's a crack in the ceiling, and an old couple bickering about a pillow-top mattress. It's my third Alex Interiors in one day, and it's the smallest yet. There's no chance he's here. There's no clearance section, no walk-in closet where fabrics hang like skirts. Another salesman approaches. How are you today, miss? You dreaming? You browsing? I tell him it's a little of both, and he says he can help me. But I'm not a helicopter, he says. You want my help with something? I'm right back there in the chair. He can't help me. No one can. But I do the same thing in this store that I do in the others. I test sofas. I pretend to be shopping, to be interested in the foam cushions, the available fabrics, the delivery time. I might be having an actual nervous breakdown as I sink into a clunky leather sectional. I didn't feel so crazy when I decided to come here, when I was in Penn Station running like a girl in a movie, exasperated, shoving my credit card into the machine, buying a one-way ticket to Providence. I knew it was only a commercial. I knew there were four furniture stores. But then it hit me. He knows I know. So it made sense that he might be waiting at one of these stores, that it was on me to come here. Sure, I've been leaving a trail of breadcrumbs since he disappeared so many years ago. He could come find me if he wanted. The salesman comes back with a transparent pillow. This will give an idea of just how much you're abusing yourself with that old mattress of yours. I sit up and nod along as he lectures me about dust mites and coils, as the old couple shake hands with the woman helping them. I knew you kids would come together one of these days. I wonder what it's like to be old, with your person. I have never felt so lonely in my life. So, the salesman says, offering his transparent pillow, do you want to give this a push? See for yourself. An hour later, I'm walking along the riverfront. They have something here called water fire, where there are lanterns on boats. There's excitement for this. Families around. College kids on mushrooms. I didn't make a plan. I didn't bring a suitcase. I don't know if I'm staying overnight. I don't know if there are hotel rooms available. I don't know what I'm eating for dinner. The only thing I know is that John didn't send me on a scavenger hunt. I'm here alone. I should have gone to a real restaurant, but it's hard to resist a Tenley's. The waitress brings me my dinner, a jalapeno burger and a fluffernutter frappe. I hope you enjoy this, honey. You get to be my age, this stuff sticks to your bones. Thank you. I say, you got it all by the Jets comes on, the way it always does in Tenley's. It doesn't change in here. It doesn't age the way we do. The music is always the same. The burger has the same sauce. The peppers have the crunch they did all those years ago. Can I get you anything else? The waitress wants to know. I take my phone out and pull out a painting of John. Actually, I say, this is so random, but can you tell me if this guy has been in here? He would be a little older now. She puts on her readers and squints, holds the phone away, then up close.
He's a looker, she says. An old beau?
I shrug, which is a weird thing to do for such a yes or no question. An old beau. Technically, no. She slides into the booth. John and I used to think this was spontaneous, that the waitresses were really caring, friendly. I remember his mom laughing at us one day.
When you go through job training there, that's on page one of the rules. They're not being friendly. That's just part of the shtick.
John and I decided that his mother was wrong, that the waitresses may be obligated to do this, but that they chose to work there because they wanted to be nice to people. My mother thinks the whole chain reeks of sexism and heart disease. The waitress studies the picture. Her name tag reads Paula.
You know, she says, before this I was a paralegal.
Oh.
31 years, she says. A firm not far from here. Big wigs. Heavy-duty stuff.
That's amazing.
Do you know why I quit?
I shake my head. No? She reaches across the table for my hand.
Because I wanted to be happy, she says. I wanted my days to smell like cheeseburgers and marshmallow fluff. I wanted to hear music and wear something comfortable and worry about nothing.
I gulp. That's really cool, to make that kind of leap. She takes off her readers.
Honey, she says, this is the thing about men. If they're right, then they come looking for you.
She pats my hand twice and slides out of the booth. I look around the restaurant. There are waitresses in all the booths, saying comforting things to people like me, gushing over kids, doling out advice to moms. I don't want his mother to be right. I don't want Tenley's to be emotionally fraudulent. When Make It Real comes on, I look at the door, and I expect John to show up. Instead, a group of guys tumble in, four of them, loud and self-conscious, amped up, full-grown man boys high on sugar. They're completely lost in each other, in black t-shirts and hats that say, I am Providence. And then I see more people like these guys, a man on his own, blissing out with a stack of books, all of them by the same author, Lovecraft. Toward the back of the room, a couple sharing a stack of pancakes, they wear matching shirts that say Lovecraft. And then it hits me. Lovecraft. That's what John was trying to get me to read when he came home, when he was so different. And now I'm searching through our old chats, all the hippocampus and, yes, all the Lovecraft.
Did you read it yet, Chloe?
He meant the Dunwich Horror. Usually I changed the subject. I didn't want to be in a horror book club with him. I did try to read it, but I could never get into it. My feelings were hurt, and then I would feel like a stereotypical girl for having hurt feelings. The book wasn't my style. It was horrible and scary and dense, and it wasn't a love poem. There was no parable of us in there, and I was always embarrassed that I wanted there to be something like that, a me and a him, some context for what we were. My face is red. The memory is too sharp. The combination of him talking to me about Lovecraft and refusing to see me in person. How it needled me, broke me. It was sexless. It was like these boys at this booth ordering onion rings. The furthest thing from their mind is girls. John would send me passages of the Dunwich Horror and ask me what I thought. It was like I was being tested, like he was trying to tell me something about us, that we were different. That I was supposed to read the right thing into the story, and then maybe he would see me. I wanted him to just come out and say what it was he wanted from me. But he never did. Lovecraft was his thing. And if it's still his thing, then that would make these people his people. My heart races and the waitress comes back with my check. Excuse me, I say, why are there all these Lovecraft fans here? She follows my gaze around the restaurant and she cackles softly. It's the big convention, she says. The Lovecraft people, we get a lot of them this time of year. And my God, let me tell you, they don't have eyes for anything but Lovecraft. Which is pretty ironic, if you ask me. I give her my credit card. Where is it? I ask. Where is the Lovecraft convention?
Eggs. The bulb in the duck lamp blew, so there's barely any light in here. It's a good omen, the universe's way of warning me. If you're gonna do this, Eggie, if you're gonna go on another wild goose chase, you best do it in the dark. I pick up Yvonne Belziki's file, and I can smell her perfume. I got in trouble over her. This is where it all began. I couldn't accept that this girl was gone. She was the picture of health. Stacy cut in, "You mean youth, Eggie." And yes, Yvonne had a look, but it was more the vitality, the sparkle. You could tell, this is a nice person. This is a kind person. It felt like her sparkle, the very thing that should have added something to her life, was the thing that killed her. I had to find out if something went wrong that day. What if there was a secret boyfriend who let her down? Something we missed. It's all still here in my boxes, the files, the security camera footage on my zip drive. There she is in her summer clothes, Yvonne Belziki. She doesn't look put upon. She looks nervous, but this is because she was going to interview for a job. She walks at a good clip, and she looks over her shoulder. It's grainy, but you know lust when you see it. Heat. I pause and zoom in the way I did so many times back then. The guy she's looking at is off screen. I nearly got myself fired trying to find this guy. Was he a stranger? A boyfriend? Was he older? Younger? Because it bumps me to this day. When she drops, the man off screen, he doesn't barge into the frame. He doesn't come running to rescue her. He didn't stick around to be interviewed. Maybe you need a break, Eggie. That was Stacy's response when I told her about my hunch that this guy might have something to do with Yvonne's heart attack. She said to leave it alone. Instead, I started sniffing around, using my badge in the way you just can't. Stacy came into my office. This time around, there was no more maybe in her speech. She sent me home. A little leave, a breather. And when I got back to work, everything was upside down. People knew that I'd been sent home. They giggled, teased me. I was the resident conspiracy theorist whack job. It's not the kind of stigma that goes away. I know the way people look at me, but I also know that my gut won't let up. Nausea that washes over me when I think about Yvonne's feline smile, Krishna's fist, pounding. These things feel connected to me, and it's my duty to honor that instinct. Good police work is math. It's also speculation. Constellations exist because someone saw them, pointed, and someone else said, "Yes, I see it too." I pop a cup of water in the microwave and dig into my boxes.
The first one after Yvonne was Maddie's son, Richie Goleb. He was a hothead chef, dropped out of Johnson and Wales. Maddie was in denial about the drugs, called it recreational self-medication. All chefs have to keep on their toes. Richie died at night, in his yard, with a leaf blower in his hand. Last time I heard from Maddie, she thought he had been poisoned, like they do in Russia. The next kid to go was Derry Sears, a real prize. He and his wife were regulars in the system, beating the hell out of each other, constantly losing custody of their four kids. He died when he was dragging the wife into the front yard. The two of them lived hard. I remember her jagged teeth, her bloody face. I asked her if there were any witnesses. "Hell if I know," she said. I remember the light breaking through the leaves. I remember thinking, it's a miracle that these trees could thrive in this hell. Needles everywhere, diapers too. These people die and people sigh, good riddance. The end. And Rita Bolt, she was only 24, textbook junkie on her way into Dunkin' Donuts. She leaves her kid in a hot car. She saved the kid's life when she died. They got off on that in the papers, but there's no mystery. Heroin is hard on the heart. Lo gets home, calls up to me, "You okay?" It's the scary thing about marriage. Already she knows. She can smell it when I'm on a trail. "Yep." I could stop. I should stop. I should delete the files. Instead, I type. Possible theories for early coronary death. Could be an illness we don't understand, a virus that goes undetected. You know the movie with Gwyneth Paltrow that disturbed the wife, Contagion? Could be something like that. Could be something in the water. Could be a drug cut with something that causes cardiac arrest. Could be an over-the-counter that reacts with alcohol. Could be laced steroids. Lo calls, "Dinner!" I go down there, but I don't tell Lo what I'm doing. Same way I won't tell Stacy I have a feeling about anything. Never tell anyone you have a feeling. You can tell them about a hunch or an instinct, but you can't go around talking about your feelings. That was the one question Lo asked when it was time to put Chucky away. Will his feelings be hurt? Will he know? Their answer, the phrase they used, "We can't know." Hey, Lolo, you ever heard the phrase, "I am Providence"? She smiles. "What are you doing reading Lovecraft?" I shrug. "Just saw it somewhere." Lo, love of my life. Lo who loves Lovecraft. Me. This is the part of me that gets in trouble. The part that thinks that has to mean something. "Hey," I say, all normal. Like I'm Stacy, like I'm not already mapping it out in my head, making the connections. The beard's hat said I am Providence. The beard loves Lovecraft. He's real to me now, real as Krish, as Yvonne. I smack my lips. Are we waiting on Marco or anyone, or should we dig in? "Dig in," she says. "It's just us." After dinner, off we go to our bedroom, where she claws at me. A different person. Screwing Lo saves me every time. It gets me out of my head. It erases everything in the world. It's a power she holds over me with her thick thighs. She always starts by nuzzling me in the kitchen. my little animal. Then she undresses. Long ago, she said she had no patience for me and my untrained fingers with regard to her complicated blouses, her numerous buttons. She likes buttons, won't wear any shirt unless it's covered in buttons. Your hands only know what they're doing when they're on my body, was what she said to me that first day this plan was made. Was anything so wonderful ever said to a man, naked? I'm down to my boxers, slipping out of my socks. I watch her on the other side of our bed, unbuttoning one shiny pink button and then another, another. Imagine how Marco and the other young bucks in her class must go home and get their rocks off just thinking about what they'd do, how they'd tear those shirts of hers off, buttons flying all around. She's near the end, and her breasts are out at me, her ever-softening breasts. Sagging is what she calls it, but that's a woman for you, finding the negative. She sighs at one of the buttons. Stubborn. It flashes through my mind. What's going to happen when she's older and arthritic? How soon that is. What a horrible thing your body is, the way it's doomed from day one. Your fate is death no matter what you do. Like Yvonne, that kid. She whistles, nods at me below the waist. What's down? I redden. Nothing, I say. Just thinking. She folds her arms over her breasts. Not about me, I hope. God, no, I say. Hey, you know how I asked you about the phrase, I am Providence? She flops on the bed, on her side, breasts out again. She pats the bed. Office hours are Tuesdays and Thursdays, Aggie, 3 to 5. I sit down. It was on this kid's hat. She unzips her pants, slacks, she calls them. You can sign up for a 15-minute block on the whiteboard outside of my office, or you can do it online. Low, I say. She stops messing with her slacks. She knows when to give up on me, when to ride me. I'm on thin ice, flaccid, distracted. What is this really about? I can't lie to her. I stare down at my feet. I wish I kept my socks on. Damn it, Eggie, you can't go obsessing again. I'm not obsessing. Oh, you're not obsessing? You mean to tell me you're just suddenly jacked up on Lovecraft? That you'd rather sit here and talk about books than get into this bed with me? Low, I know your face, Eggie. I'm sorry. For the last time, dear husband, people die. You're gonna die. I'm gonna die. Young people have heart attacks. It happens. Is it odd that it happens? That you would see it this much? Sure it's odd. But you know what, Eggie? Everything in life doesn't have an answer or a meaning. This is true in fiction where someone's orchestrating things, but it isn't life. I know that, I snap, and I do. She's right, Stacy's right. When they tell me it makes so much sense, I can turn around and make the same argument to Romy. But when I get alone, Lo lifts her head, her brown eyes. Are you with me? Always, I say. Yes. I could have been having sex with her all this time. By now we'd be done. We'd be turning on a movie, maybe A Perfect Murder. We like that one on nights like this. Sex nights. But I can't drop it. Lo, I say, like some college boy with a big idea. I was just, you know, it was a tough one. And there was this kid with this hat that said, I am Providence. Just got in my head, that's all. This isn't me digging around trying to get to the bottom of any unsolvable problems. I should stop now, but I don't. I swear to you, this isn't that. But he who doth protest too much never wins, and she is on her feet, calling me out on my stinky bullshit, hammering at me for being unable to let go, unable to accept things as they are, looking for answers that don't exist, because sometimes things just are what they are and you have to accept them. She is yelling at me, yelling at herself. I forget sometimes that he was inside of her, Chucky, that all those times I was asleep and she was awake with heartburn and rubbery feet, swollen, she had all that time with him, all that alone time. I forget that he came from us, but he came through her. He was never in me. Her pain is something I like to think of as buried. But there it is. You fucking idiot, Eggy. You crude bastard. Those pathetic words spill out of me. I'm sorry, Lo. There is no case. She puts on her no-sex clothes, pajama bottoms and a moth-eaten old Haven Brothers t-shirt. I follow her lead. I get into my no-sex clothes, too. I know, Lo. You're absolutely right on every count.
So let it go,
she barks. I am. She gives me a look.
You think I don't know you're up there squirreled away watching that video over and over? Rewinding over that kid in the hat?
Lo.
No,
she states, not giving.
We need your income, Eggy. So never mind what's possible for a minute here. Let us please live in the reality that we are not able to manage our expenses on my teaching.
I know that. She glares at me.
Good.
She's pulling at her duvet.
May your penitence be your guide.
She's searching for her glasses, scooting under the covers, shielded. We're not going to have sex or watch a perfect murder. She's turning on a light, opening her book, Seinfeldia. She's not mad. She's sad. I messed up, and because of me, her mind has drifted to Chucky, to the expenses. She's softening, which is why she is the love of my life, asking me if I want her pillow because of my back. No, thank you, honey, you keep it. She turns the pages of her book, and she's not reading, not taking in the words. I can feel her mind, full of me, full of worry. She probably thinks things like, let your husband have his little obsessions. He doesn't get to have his son. It's the least you can do. She looks at me. Well, now you got me thinking about Lovecraft. Is this a good thing? I ask. She chuckles. This is a wonderful thing. She's in her groove now, lecturing me about Lovecraft. I am Providence. That was Satan's line when he went to see St. Anthony.
I am God and I am Providence,
she booms in her teacher voice. She explains the link between the Bible and H.P. Lovecraft, who wrote the words, I am Providence, in a letter to James F. Morton.
See, listen, she tucks her hair back. I teach Lovecraft's stories, but you can't delve into his work without reading his letters. He spent most of his life writing letters, so many letters, and he was all these different things, a recluse, a bigot, a man of letters, a creative person, a depressed person, a political person. But then, also, Eggy, he knew so much about the boundaries and specifics of our government, our law. The man knew so much. He was an advisor about so much to so many, and he writes these letters, and then he writes these stories, these wild stories, almost as if the more he knew of this world, the more driven he was to make other worlds, worlds that must have been born out of some unknowable depth of confusion. His peace with that mystery, turbulent peace, if you can imagine such a thing.
I see Chucky in a room, alone. I see Lo in this room, not looking at me, looking at the floor. This is how she survives. She thinks about other things. She clears her throat. You know, she continues, when he was married, he and his wife were in New York, and she had to go away for work, and he left her. He came back here, back to good old Providence. She chuckles. Lovecraft was interested in the world. People like him, they knew all of it. They could talk about anything, and they did talk about everything. She runs her hand over the book in her lap. The Seinfeldian minutiae of a trip to the store. The meaning of life, the existence or lack of a god. This is where they had us beat, you know? She's pointing her finger at me. I'm hard as a rock, but I keep it concealed. She needs this. This is her fire, her case. Sean Anders, she nods. This kid last year tells me he thinks reading fiction is a waste because when you read nonfiction, you learn about something real, and when you read fiction, you learn about something someone made up. She cackles. I want to bend her over the side of the bed, pull those damn pants off. I wish I could listen to her and be with her at once. I wish the two desires weren't two equal beasts, jaws of life, clamped. And Lovecraft, oh, I wish he was here. I wish he could explain to Sean Anders that from the facts come the imagined. From the imagined comes the real, because that's what happens when you read Lovecraft's letters. Letters rooted in what is, nonfiction, and then an hour later you read his fiction. Wild things, things you can hardly comprehend. You think, this is horror. The worst that's possible, worse than what we can imagine. This one monster, Cthulhu. The idea is that none of us pronounce his name correctly because his name is ultimately not meant for humans. We can't pronounce it correctly. Can't. And you read fiction because it reminds you. Someone like Lovecraft. She runs her hands through her hair. One of her nipples is hard. Well, she says, it reminds you that there just might be more to the world than you realize. Maybe. I mean, you see a kid in a Lovecraft hat. You know why? Because the man is dead and he's still pulling us together. Like at the Biltmore this weekend. Every year there's a whole conference, people flooding here to talk about H.P. Lovecraft as if he's some kind of rock star. She laughs. Both of her nipples are hard now. Bottle caps beneath the cotton. She untwists her legs and slips down, deeper into the bed. Under the covers. I guess the shorter answer would be, the kid wearing the I Am Providence hat, he might be at that convention. He's wearing that hat, I hope, because he gets it, or he wants to get it, that you are fate, you are Providence, and fate is you. But then, also, so what? What the hell is Providence? What good does that do you? I am Providence is a question disguised as a statement. It's like any faith. It's blind. She smiles at me, the mind alive and calming smile, sideways, half-open mouth, shimmering teeth, the smile that says, come here, baby. So I do. Every time that damn door opens, my whole back seizes up on me. This has to be a 4-star hotel, and you'd think they'd fix a door like that on a day like this, knowing there are going to be so many people in and out, in and out. I could stop a waiter and ask if someone from maintenance could take care of it, but I'm trying to be invisible here, blend in. And it's bad enough, the way I stand out. I can't figure out why, exactly. It's not like everyone is so young. For the most part, sure, the people here are on the younger side, but you have your fair share of over 40s, too. A lot of them wear T-shirts to show their love of H.P. Lovecraft, and they mill around pointing at each other's chests. Cool shirt, dude. I've seen 3 hats that scream, I am Providence, but 0 hats attached to a face that is bearded or bruised or both. Which is why my neck tingles when that door opens again. Quack! but it's just a girl. A girl with long black hair and a big fat smile. Her smile, that's what it is. It's the happiness that gets me. Sure, I've been in happy rooms, but this is different from a wedding or a retirement party. This is a bunch of people sharing happiness, feeding off each other, as if they're a bunch of vampires biting each other's necks. Mmm, delicious. The door whanks again, and I spin around. Nope. This room, these people, are here because of books. And if Lo were here, she'd smack me.
Of course they are, Eggie. I've told you. Books save lives.
And the plain truth about me being in here, I stand out because I'm unhappy. I get a chill through my achy backside as if I saw myself in a mirror, a cold mirror. I don't like it. I don't like knowing that nothing in my life makes me this happy. Nothing except Lo. You're supposed to have more than a woman. You're supposed to have interests, things that make your eyes pop out of your head like this geek here taking a picture of the placards above the coffee. Outer God, cold brew. Darkness, dark roast. Undead, French roast. Everything here is renamed to honor their hero. There, Lovecraft. The door again. All the hope in me zings through my veins like some kid waiting on Santa. Two guys come in, both too skinny and old to be the beard, who would probably be alone. We have that much in common. But that's all insofar as I can figure. I know what to expect. I know his height, his weight. I know his hat. I am Providence. I know he'll have facial lacerations. There will be bruising, possibly a broken nose, a black eye, maybe even two. Damn hat, damn grainy footage. But the kid will be jammed up. Maybe he'll be limping. Even if he didn't go to a clinic, he'd have to do something about his ribs. If he wrapped himself up, he'll be bulky, wearing a loose shirt. The door again. Come on, buddy. I got that feeling in my gut. This is it. I smell him. A large hand, a strong leg, but then the top half. Red hair, eyeglasses, another big fat smile. I sink. Nope. The beard might be army, or he might have done time. He might have been pro ball, might have known Krish from a gym. This morning I told Lo that it might be a love triangle, or he might be a dealer. Could be a situation where the beard might know all my heart attacks.
Eggie, she said, now you're just making up stories. Is it time for us to trade jobs?
The door again.
Yeah.
But even from here I can see fingertips, painted, long and pointy. It's a girl.
Damn it.
She holds the door and the hope swims up in me. But then it's a chubby kid. Can't be more than 5'2", couldn't grow whiskers, let alone a beard.
Damn it!
I wrangle a tea bag from my pocket. I plop it into a cup of hot water and slam a saucer on top and set my timer. The woman next to me is humming, pouring coffee.
That's a lot of work for a little cup of tea.
She's smiling, too. She laughs when she spills hot coffee on her hands. The guy next to her, he's offering ice, just because he's a nice guy, not even trying to get into her pants. The magic of people who want to be together, who are together, getting what they want. This must be what it's like inside a working brain. She beams at me, lifts her cup.
Here's to dancing sober.
Excuse me?
Oh, come on, she says.
She scrolls through her phone.
Well, the exact words, almost nobody dances sober unless they happen to be insane.
I blush. I look at the door. Nothing. It's becoming possible that I was wrong, that I misdirected my focus, that the hat is a dead end, that he doesn't even know who said I am Providence, that he only bought it because he liked it. The happy little woman gives up on me, moves on to another festival goer.
Did you see the bathrooms where instead of girls it says Kasogtha?
The two of them drift off together, and I am alone.
dancing sober. I did not see the bathrooms, and I do not see the beard. The lights flicker. They're going to start. Another fan comes up. Little guy. Random, he says. What's your favorite book? Go. If Chucky were okay, this is what I'd want for him. This kind of joy. But I don't answer the question. The door opens again. Slowly this time. Someone who must have been out there hearing what I hear. That screech that grinds on your nerve endings. There is a hand, a big hand. This guy is hesitant. Delicate. Yes. I see it all at once and one piece at a time. I am Providence on the hat, pulled low, so low that the bill almost reaches the beard, the full beard, my beard. He must have two black eyes because he's wearing sunglasses, just like Romy said, textbook hipster. This is why you hang around by the coffee, why you abide your gut. It's true what they say about those hipsters. They like their coffee. The beard, he makes a beeline for the station, walking hard, tall. Ex-cop? Maybe. Drug dealer? Maybe again. I take the saucer off my cup. I dig out the bag with my fingers. The tea is going to be thin, not steeped all the way, but the beard is here. He's pouring coffee into one of those reusable cups the hipsters enjoy. I smile, the way all the happy people do. You see those bathrooms? He shakes his head. Hiding behind those sunglasses. Hiding from who? You should see him, I say. You know they covered up men and women with Lovecraft words? He pours cream. I'll check him out. Nothing in his voice. Ice cold. You hit any traffic on the way here? I ask. He shrugs. Not really. Evasive. Alone. The beard, looking around the room. I move closer to him. He moves away from me, but I'm close enough to see what he's hiding. The bruising around his left eye, blue indents, scratches. This is him. This is it. You remember last year, I say in my shooting-the-shit voice. Last year this room was bulging with people. This year, not so bad. This is my first time. He says, oh yeah? He nods. You from here? He shakes his head. Still keeps moving away from me ever so slightly, or maybe I'm moving in too strong. Nope, he says. I'm a lifer, I say. Born and raised. He nods. I moved here a little over 5 years ago. The timeline fits. Just in time to poison people with some untraceable drug that doesn't show up in an autopsy, in your blood. He's cold. I can imagine him selling powder to people. I bet Krish scored some when the girl cheated on him, when he wanted a breather. Yvonne, she probably thought it was something fun, something like Molly, one of the dancing drugs. Fuck this beard. Fuck him and his poison. I raise my cup. Here's to dancing sober. He doesn't look at me. Yeah. I catch his eye. You look like you're looking for someone. His eyes skate around, just figuring out where to sit. You meeting anyone here? He shrugs. Just looking for a chair. You working? I ask. He looks at me. Now he gets it. Now he knows that I'm working, that I want him to know I'm working. Yes, I say. Yes, I'm a cop. He backs away, tiniest bit. Cool. Is it? His hand is shaking. Up front there's a woman walking up to the podium. People are on their feet, hooting, clapping. The door opens and I don't hear that noise. The beard is sweating. This is easier than I thought it would be. I put down my cup. Tea's not steeped enough anyway.
no loss there, and gently take the back of his arm. He's jacked. He could have fought back. And lead him to the door. Nobody notices because all eyes are on the front. All eyes except my eyes. My eyes are on him. The beard. I tap his head. He jerks. Calm yourself, son. I'm just here to ask about that hat of yours. That's one hell of a hat. You can see his heart beating like in the old Bugs Bunny cartoons. He gulps. Thanks, I should get a seat. But he doesn't move. He knows he can't. Feels it. Me. Sure, I say. You remember where you got that hat? I didn't see him downstairs. Maybe you could show me. There's so much down there, you know? Hard to know what's what. He nods, no words left. And we're walking out the door, and I ask him about his black eye. Rollerblading, he says. I hit the button for the elevator. My son rollerblades. What kind of skates you got? He hangs his head, silenced. We wait for the elevator. He can't answer because he's lying. I caught him. I hear the muted roar of applause inside that ballroom, and a wave of nausea crushes me. It's no fun getting old when your whole body is turning against you. I get like this a lot lately. The twinge in my gut, the feeling I might faint, fall over. The kid eyes me.
This is harassment, he says. You have no grounds to be doing this.
Little shit. Cold-blooded, but of course he is. The elevator dings. I turn it on now. The big dip, the big switch. I suggest you shut your mouth so you don't get another shiner to match the one you already got. He didn't fight back with Krishna, and he doesn't fight back with me. I was able to make the lineup happen because it's Saturday. Stacy's at a birthday party, and I'm senior enough that nobody's watching me, not on the weekend. Amazing how even in a police station you can feel it, the weekend, the desire to work a little less harder, to skate by. I got six guys in the lineup, and this could never be admissible in court, but this isn't about court. The beard shut down on me in the car when I cuffed him. Wouldn't tell me where he gets his shit, wouldn't say a word when I drove him by Brown, down onto Fair, where you can't even get into the falafel place because of all the flowers. Any of this ring a bell? I asked him. Nothing. I tried again. Did you want to tell me how you knew Krish? More nothing. Is that what the poison is called? I am Providence? Is that why you wear the hat? Or were you there because you were selling to someone? Where's your stash? Did you rip off Krishna? Do you move hard on the RISD kids? I imagine they enjoy their drugs. Goes well with their art. Every question got more nothing. The hat, the silence, the guilt. And now it's time for something. Bring him in, I say, commencing the lineup. The beard walks out along with five other scuzzos I pulled in, all of them with their mangy, hairy faces, all in those heavy-billed hats, the hoodies, the loose jeans. And my witness leans forward, my Romy, ever the good citizen.
Well,
she says. Nah, nah, I say. I want you to be quiet for a few minutes. I want you to look, not react, not yet. You just look. What I've learned so far today is that Romy is a philosophy major, God help me, with an Addy prescription and a paper due. She talks a lot. She was dying to come in here because she loves real life, and she's like a lost kitten since Krish died. See how people do that? How they make someone into something? Romy forgets that I know it all, how close they were, how close they weren't. But when she got here, she was wearing a men's crew sweatshirt, drowning in it, as if it was hers to wear, as if he was hers to mourn. She wants so badly to be the hero, the bereaved savior who overcomes her red eyes to bring justice to Krishna. She wants it so bad she can't put that fever aside and think. She's posturing, an actress waiting to make her entrance. She told me she read a lot about the justice system, and she's hesitant to rely on her own eyes, subject as they are to her sentimentalizing the incidents at hand. I told her to put her faith into herself as well as the system. She talked over me about the nature of observation and perception, her hesitance to assume a participatory role in justice without comprehending the extent of my contribution. I promised her that this is way too early for consequences. Romy, I say, lowering my voice, you are one witness, and this is all very preliminary, and your identifying this man isn't enough. So don't worry. What you're doing here today is helping me out. You don't have the power to put anyone away. Now, which one is he? She sucks in her cheeks. Well, she says. She holds that air in. Kills me. Puffs it out. Well, he's not here. Romy, take a minute. I would know him if I saw him. I would know. As you yourself said earlier, your memories are colored by your emotions. Right, she says, but that has nothing to do with the fact that he's not here. He was bigger than these guys, and he looked sad, lonely somehow. That's likely you projecting your own feelings onto him. No, she snaps, confident, excruciating. Believe me, I got a good look at him, a long look. Were you on Addy then? Her cheeks burn. Watch it, Eggie. Sorry, I say. I just want you to take time. I know you've got your paper due, your stress, losing Krish. This is a situation in your life where you can relax. You can take all the time you need. You know, I can talk to your professor, get you more time if you need it on that paper. She looks into the room where my beards are all lined up, as I told them to be. But something strange is happening. My beards are filing out of the room, one by one. I run to the door, and Stacy's right outside. Eggie, she says, how's your weekend going? You having some fun? Stacy, how much did she hear? How much does she know? How about you come down to my office and tell me about all the fun you're having, because that's much more important to me than Sonny's baseball game. T-ball. Sure thing, Cap. She spins around, and I can't face Romy. The room where all the beards were. All the hope. Can't even follow my own train of thought right now. What am I going to say? How am I even possibly going to defend myself? Romy eyes me. Was that your boss? My neck seizes up in the bad way, the opposite of the way it did back at the Biltmore, back when there was hope. In a manner of speaking, Romy smiles. I love that you report to a woman. That makes me feel so good about all this. In her office, Stacy gives me a look. It turns out my beard was a domestic violence victim. He was at that conference looking for his boyfriend. He'd called in the abuse several times. He wasn't even in Providence the night Krish died. He was in a hospital in Wareham. What was he doing at the Lovecraft convention if he lives in Wareham? He found that hat in his boyfriend's car. He was there on a hunch. Eggie? She says when she's through. She stands up and opens the door. I know. Do you? Because you gotta let it go. I don't look at my colleagues as I walk out to my car. It's enough to feel them glancing over their computer screens, knowing. There's no denying what today was all about. All the Lovecraft people, their toothy smiles, the love in their fingertips, holding doors open. So passive, these sweet, gooey people, hearts like Lowe's. This is what they're drawn to. Violence. Gore. Innocent people like dark things. It's not rocket science. It's that rule of opposites and attraction. I get in my car, and when I watch the video of the beard getting his ass kicked, I know him. He's not a drug dealer. He's a goddamn puppy. A Lovecraft fan. The truth creeps up on me like a kid in a schoolyard. What Stacy knew. What they all knew. Everybody in the station. I might be wrong. The beard is probably a soft, sweet, passive soul. Probably missed the conference today because he was home nursing his wounds. Probably never harmed a soul in his life. Probably never will. I should stop looking for him. In a moment like this, you can make that kind of decision. And then you can rewind the video. You can watch it again.
John, it was so easy to be brave on the drive over, but I froze up and missed the whole Lovecraft conference. I came here, but I didn't go in. I failed. Now Dr. Wu is outside of a black car. She's going to get in it soon, and she's going to go, and then I will have wasted my whole day sitting here, not taking control of my life, not trying to find a way out of this mess. I step out of my car. That skin-crawling sensation overtakes me again, that sense of someone lurking. I whip my head around, but there is nothing. No one. I focus on my breathing. Slow and steady. I pull my cap down low. I am Providence. I walk up to her, Dr. Lin Wu, a smallish, strongish woman who smells of black licorice and fancy shampoo. I tap her on the shoulder. She turns. She smiles.
Well, you're a tall drink of water.
Can I ask you something about the Dunwich Horror? She laughs.
Is this something we didn't cover in the 2-hour seminar?
She's trying to be nice, but I can't take in the kindness. I can't look at her. I have to look through her. Feel nothing. Focus. What if they could have fixed Wilbur? Wilbur could change, I say. People change.
People, yes, maybe, she says. Monsters, no.
But what if they could have fixed him? Turned him back? She's studying me. She's thinking.
Hun, she says. Have we met? You look so familiar.
I feel my body heating up. I shake my head. I don't think so.
Well, she says. Wilbur was growing fast because he was only part human. When he dies, there's no blood. He's literally supernatural.
What if they had done a blood transfusion, I ask. Like, if they had replaced the yellow bile, that stuff that made him a monster. I mean, couldn't they have made the human part of him bigger than the monster part? She smiles.
You're adorable, she says,
and she likes me. She's amused. She isn't taking me seriously. I have the urge to tell her everything. How I've never gone to Meany because he knew Roger Blair. I'd feel too much. This was safe because she's a stranger. But now I'm here. She's here. I forgot how easy it is to feel something for someone, and that I should warn her that I am Wilbur, sort of, and she has 30 seconds to help me or die. But how could I really do that? How could I tell her? I do my stern voice. Lovecraft goes on and on about him being part human. He makes us see him as a baby, growing up fast, too fast. But still, he's like you and me. He has a mother. And she shifts gears. She gets serious, even a little impatient.
She says Dunwich is part of the larger Cthulhu story, and the most noteworthy thing about this story is that it has a happy ending. My cheeks turn red.
But he dies. Wilbur dies.
Yes, she says. That's precisely what I'm saying. Sure, there is a bloodbath. His actions do lead to a lot of death, but there is an end to it. And we, the readers, get to feel relieved, like the town won this round. Wilbur is dead. The horror has come and gone.
She rubs her forehead. She's getting dizzy, and I am running out of time. My voice is low and shaky. But what if things could have ended differently?
She flashes her eyes at the driver. She wants out of this conversation. You're still talking as if there's something redeemable about Wilbur.
Well, he isn't all bad. He saved his brother.
She laughs. You're a piece of work, she says. And I swear I know you. Were you here last year? The Cthulhu breakfast? The first day?
I push her again. The clock ticks. The one inside of me, the one that tells me there isn't much time until my heart starts to attack. I'm feeling things, terrible things, dread, resentment. My voice comes out like a hiss. I'm just trying to figure out how they could have saved Wilbur.
They couldn't have, she says, snapping. The goal is to kill Wilbur because his goal is to kill us. Here he is in our backyard, and he's going to kill us. What's scarier than that?
She wipes her forehead.
I feel pink, she says. Do I look pink?
But he was part human, I insist. He was born to a mother. He has a brother. He's a person. He does start out that way. She moves toward her car.
That might be the scariest thing of all, she says. Doesn't matter that you're a little good if you're mostly made of evil.
Her nose begins to bleed, and I can barely get the words out. Thank you. She just gave me my death sentence.
And now she slinks into her big town car, disappearing like one of Lovecraft's monsters.
And then I look into the lobby at all the happy people. I blink. I rub my eyes.
Yes. No. Yes,
that's who I think it is. And I see her, and she sees me, and I stop moving because I can't move. It's her. Chloe.
Chloe. I bought a shirt in the lobby. Shoggoths in bloom. I don't know what a shoggoth is, but I like the word. I like the Nirvana song In Bloom, and I didn't want to look like an outsider, a girl searching for love, especially around all this requited passion, obsessed people coming together to fuel and feed this love. I take the glass elevator up to the 15th floor, and the bottom drops out of my stomach. "Excuse me," a girl says, smiling fully, so un-Manhattan. "Do you want me to pull your tag off?" Upstairs, the conference rooms and the hallways are stuffed with Lovecraft people, more men than women, costumed, energized. These people live for this. They wait for this. This is their World Series, their wedding day. It's so easy to picture John here. So easy to imagine that he's found a home with people the way he never could when we were kids, or never wanted to. I feel him everywhere. He would call this my spidey sense. I see a guy picking over bagels at the buffet. That could be John. I walk over there, but it isn't him. I see another guy adjusting a black robe, laughing at something. My heart is beating faster. But then he raises his head to scratch his neck and, no, not John again. I go back in the glass elevator to the lobby and ride with the Lovecrafters, up and down. It would have been fun to be here with Noelle, to hear her little comments. I miss her. I miss John. I am dizzy with missing, and I wander around downstairs until I convince myself that he's upstairs, that I missed him. And I get back into the elevator where two guys are raving about a reenactment of the Dunwich Horror. Excuse me, I say. That's a book, right? They look at me like I'd just bought my shirt in the lobby. Long story, I say. But was that reenactment today? Did you see this guy there? I shove my phone at them, my John drawing. No, they didn't. Upstairs, I dawdle around the buffet table with an empty plate, an obvious prop. Someone taps my shoulder. A guy with glasses, fake tentacles attached to his naked scalp like extensions. He smiles. You look lost, he says. I'm not lost, I say. Just looking for my friend. He raises his eyebrows. For your boyfriend? I don't know, I say, and I sound like a weirdo. I am the weirdo with my empty plate, my I don't know, and stiff new shirt. The guy is backing away. Good luck, he says. I pick up a hard croissant. I don't know. How can that be true? I know so much. I know what I do. I know where I live. But none of it matters if you don't know who you love. I gnaw on the old croissant. It may as well be cardboard. I know I love John from afar. I never turn my ringer off at the movies in case this is the time he says something when he calls. But I think love is something you have to do up close, in a room like this, with circulated air and intermittent squealing.